Stoller, we have Dr. Bowen as the next speaker.
Dr. Bowen, welcome.
Thank you. Should I go? Okay, and is it working up there? I can't tell.
Apparently, the closer you are to that mic, the easier we are.
I can't get much closer.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I have provided written testimony, and as you know, our State of the Market report set out the Market Monitoring Unit's views on... our State of the Market report set out the Market Monitoring Unit's views on PJM markets fairly exhaustively. I'll briefly summarize the key points, and I look forward to answering your questions. Prices, which are everyone's concern, are a key outcome of markets. Prices may reflect a variety of factors, from supply-demand conditions to scarcity to input costs and even to market power. Prices in competitive markets signal the value of resources to both suppliers making decisions about investments and producing, and they also provide signals to consumers making both short and long-term consumption decisions. Higher prices are not inherently good or bad. They're not a goal. Lower prices are not inherently good or bad, and they're also not a goal in markets. The goal is to get prices right, and we can talk about what that means, but what I mean by prices being right is that they reflect the actual marginal costs, actual incremental costs of producing, in this case, power. And that would both be both the marginal cost of, short-run marginal cost to produce energy, as well as the marginal cost of providing the capacity. As an example, environmental policy, which has been spoken about a little bit this morning on carbon, relies on price signals. Carbon credits, regardless of whether it's a tax, an auction, or however it's structured, will and do have a price. That price will result in higher energy prices and changes in behavior. That's the explicit design of carbon policy, is to use market prices to induce behavior. Energy prices in PJM, as we know, have risen, although not steadily, since the inception of PJM markets in 1999. Although prices rose almost 16% in 2007, despite that, 2007 prices were actually lower than they were in 2005. And although prices in 2008 for the first 6 months of the year continued, in fact accelerated that upward trend, since June, energy prices in PJM have declined. As you've heard from Andy and others, a fundamental driver of energy prices in PJM is fuel costs. Fuel costs comprise 80 to 90% of generation marginal costs. Therefore, it's not surprising that they have a significant impact on prices. The cost of coal and natural gas are especially critical in PJM markets, as they are on the margin together, or one or the other, virtually 100% of the time. As an example, and I know this doesn't give solace, and it doesn't mean that higher prices are easier to tolerate, but nonetheless, as an explanatory factor, if fuel prices in 2007 were at the same level as they had been in 1999, holding all else constant, prices would have been around $33 instead of around $60. Again, not surprising given that fuel comprises such a large portion of marginal costs. As I indicated, fuel prices have declined since June, and energy prices have correspondingly declined since June. Capacity prices, another key topic. Capacity prices declined substantially between 1999 and 2007. They went from in the mid-50s early on in 1999 to about $3 in the last auctions run between January and May of 2007. RPM, as we know, has resulted in substantially higher capacity prices. But RPM prices are reflective of the actual cost to build new generation or to reinvest in existing generation. Those prices are reflective of the incremental cost of capacity. Now, there have been questions and reasonable questions about what the test of competition, what the test of markets are. Net revenue is one of the key tests that we apply. Net revenue is a key measure of overall market performance as well as market incentives. High prices by themselves do not result necessarily in higher net revenues. As a matter of fact, what we saw between 1999 and 2000, the first parts of 2007, was higher energy prices, but in fact, net revenues, which are typically significantly below the replacement cost of new capacity across all technology types. Net revenues have increased as a result of RPM, not surprisingly, and that addressed a fundamental gap in the market design, and that was the intent of RPM. The results of the first full year, and we've shown that in the testimony, the first full year of RPM, so the planning year, which runs from June 2007 to May 31st, 2008, was to increase net revenues across all technology types to at or above the replacement cost of capacity in the eastern zones where capacity is needed, but not in the rest of our RTO footprint. So it had its intended locational impact, and net revenues in the east reflected that. High prices in the presence of high input costs do not mean a problem with markets. In fact, it's evidence that markets are operating well. That's what we'd expect in competitive markets. High prices in the presence of scarcity do not mean that markets are not working well. In fact, that's what we would expect in a competitive market. But high prices make it more critical than ever that we ensure that prices really reflect competitive outcomes. All market participants across the spectrum need to be assured that in times of high prices particularly, but at all times obviously, that market outcomes reflect competition and do not reflect market power. Competition is a tool of regulation for FERC. We're in an area of restructuring, not deregulation. True deregulation going to pure laissez-faire markets would not work and will not work. It will never be an adequate approach for wholesale power markets. Market forces in a defined structure can be very powerful motivators of behavior. But that defined structure remains required and will remain required. Competition used as a tool of regulation requires clear and effective market power mitigation rules. We have such rules in PJM, the three pivotal supplier test. The three pivotal supplier test, which is currently under review in a paper hearing by FERC, is essential to maintaining competitive outcomes in PJM. And I know, Commissioner Christie, you asked Andy about this earlier, but the most direct measure of competitive outcomes in the energy market is markup. The difference between the actual price at the margin charge and the cost of producing that power. The actual prices in PJM are set by units typically operating at or extremely close to marginal cost. Markup is not zero, but it's very close, and it leads us to conclude that the results of the energy market continue to be competitive. We made a similar evaluation of the capacity markets, looking at the incremental cost of providing capacity, and reached that same conclusion. That is, the results of the capacity markets in PJM continue to be competitive. Now, let me say in closing that I do not and would not assert that PJM markets are competitive. They are competitive. I would not assert that PJM markets are perfect. They're not perfect. Work continues to be needed to be done. In the RPM area, there's an active stakeholder process, so working on modifying the rules. Scarcity pricing is an area that needs work. The three pivotal supplier test is in play now in front of FERC. It's certainly the interaction between generation and transmission investment needs to be looked at. So while we find the results to be competitive, I'm not asserting that the markets are perfect. Thank you. I look forward to your questions.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. Gentlemen, Paige, thank you for being here and taking the time. It's great to have you here. On page two of your testimony, you have the chart on the PJM real-time numbers, and it looks like for 2008 so far, an average rate of 7.7 cents a kilowatt hour.
Yes.
If you were to add some RPM credits to that, converting that into cents per kilowatt hour, would it be safe to say that would be now in maybe the 8.5 cent range?
I'd be happy to do the exact math for you on the side. What I would say is, if you look at the net revenue calculations, they've done that effectively in total revenues. But you go ahead. Sorry.
Okay. I'm just trying to establish what the current rate might look like. And when I look at, again, the definition of the measure of competitiveness, that we look at something close to zero above the cost, and in the case of when we have a market that's mitigated, that we look at 10% above cost as being a reasonable level of quote, a competitive market, I'm just really struggling to understand how these numbers that I'm seeing here are not significantly above the marginal energy cost of our coal and nuclear-fired facilities in Pennsylvania. Right before I came here and took this position, I had an ownership interest in the plant that if I was getting these kind of numbers, if I knew I was going to get these kind of numbers, I wouldn't be sitting here today. They're just so much farther above than the marginal energy cost of the unit that I was associated with. And I know we have a substantial amount of coal and nuclear facilities in Pennsylvania, and again, 90% of our generation comes from those resources, and we're exporting energy from those facilities. And the statistics I see on the cost of the marginal energy cost of these units, not to pick on PPL, but PPL has a pretty good coal and nuclear fleet, and their numbers are clearly under 3 cents a kilowatt hour. The chart I saw is 1.6 cents a kilowatt hour. So I'm really just struggling to understand, as a matter of fairness in Pennsylvania, why we are subject to such high prices for the bulk of our generation being what I consider to be relatively low cost. Now, maybe I'm missing it here, and their marginal energy cost is 6-7 cents a kilowatt hour, but I know from my own personal experience, and I thought I had one of the higher running units in PJM, I don't understand it.
Okay. First of all, 90% of total energy across the entire footprint. Sorry, I'm too close to the mic.
Yeah.
90% of total energy across the entire footprint comes from coal and nuclear plants. So it's not a unique feature of Pennsylvania. But secondly, what you're really asking me about is what economists call the inframarginal rents. That is the money you make between your actual marginal costs and whatever the actual marginal costs are setting the price. So if I'm a coal unit and there's gas on the margin, clearly I'm making more than my marginal cost. But for a coal unit in a restructured environment, which is not receiving rate-based rate of return revenues, the source of dollars to cover fixed costs is that difference between the actual market price and the marginal cost of production. Now, about 70% of the time, coal units actually are on the margin, and it's the remaining 30% of the time in PJM that gas units are on the margin. So as a ratepayer, as a customer in Pennsylvania, neither you nor I or I think could reasonably expect to pay only the incremental cost of coal, $87.60, because that would not result in compensation to coal unit owners, nor would it result in incentives to build new units. So the whole notion of a single clearing price auction that Andy and you spoke about earlier is precisely this, that the difference between the incremental cost of the units actually running and the unit on the margin goes to cover those other costs associated with producing energy. And just as a measure, I mean, it's clearly a critical question. We look at that very directly, and that's the measure of net revenues. So we look at the difference between the price and the marginal cost for every unit in PJM, as well as these by technology type. We add in the RPM revenues, and we see what the result is. And the result, as you can see, is quite close to, in many cases, below the actual incremental cost of building new capacity.
Maybe it's worth asking the question, how do you establish what the marginal energy cost is of these PJM units? Because, again, I'm struggling to understand. If I have a coal-fired unit with a heat rate of maybe 12,000, and even if coal goes up to $4 an MMBTU, I'm still under 5 cents a kilowatt hour for my marginal energy cost. And those are some pretty high numbers there. So maybe there's an issue with respect to how we're establishing the marginal energy cost. Because, you know, if you look at if these coal and nuclear plants really aren't receiving much more than their marginal cost, then how are they making so much additional on the holding companies and the increase in the earnings that they're receiving from their generation fleet? There's a mismatch there. They have to be producing at less cost and getting higher price in order to generate those kind of earnings as a contributor to their bottom line.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me just be very clear. So let's say when a coal unit is on the margin and it's charging its marginal cost, it's not receiving anything more than its actual marginal cost of production. When a gas unit is on the margin, charging $100 a megawatt hour or $200 a megawatt hour, and a coal unit is charging $50 a megawatt hour, clearly the coal unit is earning revenues over and above its marginal costs. Those revenues, as you just described, go to cover the fixed costs of owning a coal unit, the capital cost, depreciation, taxes, return, and so forth. The way we directly determine the marginal cost of production is to look at the cost, the actual cost of the fuel, the heat rates of the units, the variable O&M, and in many cases, also the cost of emissions allowances, or the fundamental pieces of marginal costs.
Okay. The next set of questions I have is related to, it was my understanding that the reason we had LMP was to try to provide an incentive for people to build capacity in certain regions. And so LMP didn't quite work, so then we needed to layer RPM on top of that. And it just seems to me that we keep adding these value streams on top of each other. And are we at the point where maybe we should think about an alternative design here where you either get one or the other, that perhaps if you get an RPM credit that maybe you should have to bid your unit in at cost, that maybe getting both is a double dip to some extent. And particularly in Pennsylvania, some of our units are still getting stranded cost investment. They're getting stranded cost, they're getting LMP, they're getting RPM. And I just think that maybe we should be taking a look at that. I'd be curious your comments on that.
Okay. Well, without commenting on stranded costs, because that's not really an issue for wholesale market design. That's an issue for you all, for the states, I believe. let's look at the revenue streams from RPM and energy. As a matter of fact, those units who receive RPM revenues, in fact, are obligated to offer in the day-ahead energy market. And our results make it quite clear that, as a general matter, the units that are setting price are offering in at their marginal cost. So when you say, shouldn't they get one or another, in fact, you need those two revenue streams in order to cover the incremental cost of capacity across technology types. Now, there is an alternative design, which would be to have all of the revenues be in the energy market and to do much more explicit scarcity pricing. It's really the same revenues. You can have them in the energy market, which would mean higher prices at times, or you can have them in the capacity market. But effectively, it's necessary to ensure that the market outcomes provide adequate incentives to reinvest. I mean, ultimately, the test of a market is whether it's reproducible, whether it provides incentives to continue, whether it provides incentives to continue to invest in new generation and to invest the dollars in old generation required to keep it viable. So part of the reason we do the detailed analysis we do is because the questions you ask are eminently reasonable. I mean, they're the fundamental questions about whether the market's working and working reasonably. That's why we look at net revenues. That's why we look at marginal costs. That's why we look at net revenues both in the energy market and the capacity markets. And that's the basis on which I draw the conclusions I draw.
Yeah. Just a couple other real quick questions on RPM. I think our colleague across the street, Senator Popowski, put it in a nice way. If you need a drink of water, you pick up your glass, you take a little shot, and you get your water. It seems with RPM, when you need a drink of water, you set off the alarms, and the fire sprinkler system goes off, and it spreads it out across the room. I just think at the end of the day, when we need capacity, that maybe we should think about having auctions and paying people that need to build a new generation and putting the generation where it's needed and giving them what they need to build their generation. Because when I look at the results of spending $30 billion over 4 years, and I just don't see the value proposition there for the consumers at the end of the day by rewarding the people who've got the stranded cost, got the LMP, and now they're getting RPM on top of it. I just think we're not getting the value stream out of that.
Okay, well, again, just LMP by itself demonstrably does not provide adequate revenue to incent new investment. It demonstrably does not cover the fixed cost of generation. So then the question is, do you do scarcity pricing of some kind, or do you do capacity market? If you do it all scarcity pricing, the revenues to generators would look very similar. You'd have very high prices for a significant number of hours during the year, and every unit who was generating, regardless of whether their marginal costs were $10 or $300, would receive those high prices. Those high prices would be in the vicinity of $1,000 for multiple hours during the year. That's certainly another way to design the markets. PJM members, PJM stakeholders, including everyone, determined that they didn't want to go that way yet, scarcity pricing, and that's why scarcity revenues are being collected via the RPM construct, via capacity markets. But RPM and LMP together are not by design, are not designed to over-recover, to overpay. Quite the reverse. They're designed to pay the actual incremental cost, total incremental cost of production.
Just one final question, and this is one that probably bothers me as much as anything. I understand that if you get an RPM credit, and if you don't perform, if you're not available when you're needed, that you still get to keep 50% of your RPM credits.
You must have been reading my white papers, because I ever had exactly the same criticism. I've raised the criticism formally in the PJM process. The performance metric for generators achieving RPM is that, as you just said, if you don't perform at all, you could still receive 50% of your capacity revenues. I believe that 100% of those revenues should be at risk. That's one of the reasons we're in the process of addressing revisions to the RPM rules, and I've raised that issue. It's being explicitly considered, and we intend as market monitoring to continue to assert that issue needs to be addressed.
Thank you, Joe, and again, I thank you for your independence, and thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Commissioner Paulson.
Thanks. Dr. Barron, again, thank you for being with us. Always enjoy your presentation. I am going to quote a GAO study, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it. Here's the comment that was outlined in the report by the GAO. It says, many agree that RTOs have improved the management of the transmission grid and improved generator access to it. However, it goes on to say, there is no consensus about whether RTO markets provide benefits to consumers or how they have influenced consumer electricity pricing. Would you like to comment on that?
Sure. It's obviously a very broad topic, and as Andy indicated before, there are studies on all sides of this. I think it's very difficult. I mean, as a former academic and an economist, it's very difficult to do those studies in a reasonable way. And I've spoken with and been on panels with academics who have tried to review all the studies and have found very significant very significant methodological issues with almost all of them. So it's very difficult to do that. But what I can tell you is, as a close observer of the PJM market, is that we know the outcomes are competitive. We know, for example, that between 1999 and 2007, every investor in new power plants lost money. And that would not have happened under rate-based rate of return. Now, whether that translates into a different overall payment by customers over that time, I haven't analyzed, but I can tell you that we believe the markets were competitive during that time period and resulted in significant undercompensation, particularly to those builders of new generation who built in anticipation of market pricing in PJM.
Thank you.
Commissioner Pinson-Billy.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Just a question on the transition to being independent. How has that gone? Are there any open issues? And do you have adequate resources available to you to meet your future needs?
Yeah, thanks. August 1st, we set up a separate shop. We're leasing space on the campus of PJM from a landlord that also leases some space to PJM. As you indicated, we have a physically separate shop. We have our own IT. We have a fiber optic cable back to PJM to ensure high-speed data transmission. We have we're covered in the tariff. We have adequate resources. We're still hiring people. The transition is still ongoing. As I found out, it's a lot harder than it sounds to make this transition. But I believe that we have adequate resources. I believe we're continuing to do the work, and the relationship with PJM is dramatically improved. We're in a cooperative relationship with PJM. Obviously, we're not always going to agree, but nonetheless, we're in a cooperative, constructive, intellectual engagement with PJM over the critical market issues. So, thank you for asking, and I think that the goal of the settlement has been achieved, which is we are clearly independent, and we have the resources to do the job we need to do.
Good. Thank you. That's good to hear.
Commissioner Gardner.
Thank you, Dr. Bowring, for being here. And I'd like to go on public record today in expressing my sincere appreciation for Dr. Bowring's infinite patience. We pose a challenge to Dr. Bowring, I'm sure, but he always deals with us in a very professional way, and we're very appreciative. Now, having said that, you have made a report, and you just made a comment to that effect, that in 9 of the last 10 years, the investor-owned utilities, the generating companies, have lost money from their operating experience. I don't know any place in a capitalist society where the investors would allow you to lose money for 9 out of 10 years and still continue to be an investor in that company. Can you explain that?
Yeah, sure. And if I apologize if I was unclear. I'm not saying that in 9 out of 10 years owners are every participant, every owner of generation in PJM lost money. What I was saying is that for those who built new generation during that time period, the revenues from PJM markets were not adequate to cover the fixed costs of new generation. I have not looked specifically at the profitability of the individual entities in PJM, whether they be regulated or unregulated entities. So I'm not speaking to whether or not, in aggregate, company by company, these entities were profitable.
Are you aware, again, of single individual companies that have gone out of business, generating companies that have gone out of business in the last 10 years as a result of low prices?
There's certainly been at least one significant bankruptcy in PJM of a generation owner. There's been substantial sale and resale of generating assets. Again, don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not saying that for existing entities with existing generation that was built under the regulatory regime, that they have necessarily been on net losing money. I don't have any reason to believe that they have been. However, what we're thinking about in market design is how to ensure that the market design incents new investment. And new investment at the margin has not been adequately incented over the years of, with a year or two exception, over the years of PJM's experience, and that's the point of the market design going forward.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, and I am having a little bit of problem hearing you, is that the new entrants into the market are much more at risk than the incumbents?
If for those who built generation between 1999 and 2007,
right.
Yes, there was a significant risk, and unless they were in a bilateral contract which gave them above market revenues, the evidence is that there was a shortfall in covering the fixed costs of building those generating stations.
My final question is, again, goes to demand response. And what would be the implication of a robust demand response program, particularly in Pennsylvania, but across PJM? What effect could it possibly have on the wholesale price of electricity?
I think economists talk about one-sided markets. We have a supply side, but not much of a demand side. So clearly what we want is both sides of the market to work effectively. The more that customers can see prices in real time, can respond to them in real time, and then can benefit or pay the costs in real time, the more likely it is we are to have an effective, competitive, efficient market. PJM's role in all that is simply to attempt to ensure that price signals get to the end-use customers, but demand side in PJM is not entirely the programs run by PJM. They're individual utility programs or state programs, and they're simply the reaction of individual customers to prices. So, as you all have mentioned some of your questions, getting the infrastructure right, getting metering right, facilitating customers being able to do those things, to be able to see prices and react to them and benefit from that reaction, are the critical elements in ensuring that demand side really works.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Bowring, thank you again for being here.
Yes, sir.
Let me see if I understand RPM and get your reaction, and I'll see if I understood an earlier answer. Before we enacted our deregulation, Electric Deregulation Act in Pennsylvania in 1996. The utilities owned the generation for the most part. They did planning to ensure there was adequate reliability in place and the transmission system was commensurately constructed. So after electric deregulation took place, all the inefficiencies of that process that I just described, where if there was downtime, customers ended up paying for it, and if there were cost overruns in building, well, customers had to pay for it. But after deregulation, the burdens and those risks were taken away from captive customers and placed with investors who would build the generation and transmission. And PJM would oversee all this to make sure there was adequate reliability and adequate transmission. Am I right so far?
Yes.
So, now that the risk is over on investors to build adequate generation and maybe transmission as well, they have to be incented to do so. They have to receive an adequate return. And I have been told that it is politically probably impossible to ever raise the energy price adequate enough to provide that return. So therefore, you have to make it up some other way, so you create a capacity market. There's some other charge that is where the revenues go to incent investors to build adequate generation. Am I still okay?
Yes, although I don't accept the premise, although I agree with you, it's a commonly accepted premise that somehow we can't have high enough energy prices to make a capacity market unnecessary. And I think that having been through the experience with the capacity markets, all participants are rethinking that, and what RPM will give everyone the ability to do now is to decide whether we want more rational scarcity pricing and in fact shift some of those scarcity revenues away from the RPM markets into the energy markets. So you don't actually have to have a price above $1,000 in order to have effective scarcity pricing, in order to have the revenues in energy market. It's a combination of the level of the price and the duration of the price. But in any event, so
RPM isn't the entire answer. You think that energy prices should be raised as well?
No, what I think is when we're thinking about prices and we're thinking about prices that reflect incremental costs, that there's a design choice to be made, and it doesn't have to be either or. The design choice is between collecting scarcity revenues, that is the revenues that will flow in a competitive market to generators when we're literally running out of power. So scarcity revenues can be collected either in the energy market or in the capacity market or in some combination of the two. So it's not about raising prices, it's ensuring the prices are right.
Okay, so you're going to design some market that's going to, in the end result, provide the right incentives. I mean, is that?
That's the goal.
Well, I've always thought that rather than the existing RPM, where existing generation is rewarded as well as new generation is incented, that we go to a RFP or an auction process, whatever it is, using PJM studies to build plants where congestion exists, and therefore we, instead of using a RPM approach, which seems to be a shotgun approach for a rifle problem, you would target the need where it is most needed, or the revenues where they're most needed. Instead, we have adopted, it appears to me, approach where you've incented people who have no intention of building anything, and especially not where it needs built it and when it needs built. Now, I wish someone would disabuse me of that if I'm wrong, but that's my impression of RPM.
Well, I'm not sure I can disabuse you of anything, but let me try to answer. I mean, there are a number of complicated issues in your question. One has to do with the difference between old units and new units, and there's no question but that in RPM, the transition from a regulatory regime to RPM undoubtedly could have been handled better. And it's certainly the case that there are units under your or formerly under your jurisdiction, as well as in other states, that receive stranded costs, for example, and that state commissions are concerned about that. Now, that's certainly an issue. The question is whether that should change the view of what the right market structure is going forward. If you build a new unit under RPM, it's going to be an old unit the next year. But the RPM design is intended to and will continue to compensate those units for their life. But that I agree does not address what's been called the legacy plant issue, the stranded cost issue, the issue of old units in states like Pennsylvania. It's very difficult to see how an incremental market design could do that without direct action by state authorities. There's no question that that's an issue. I'm not sure that's an issue which is resolvable by market design. But then the second piece has to do with RFPs for capacity. I think everyone remembers, because it's not that long ago, PURPA contracts. That's what they were. They were RFPs for capacity, and they were massively overpaid as a frequent occasion. And in fact, PURPA contracts were fixed price based on assumed escalation of gas costs, and illustrated the difficulty with the regulatory approach to things as well. Now, the goal on the market side, as you indicated before, is to put investors at risk, and all you're assured of getting in RPM when you sell your capacity into the market is really 1 year's worth of revenues on a project that's likely to last a minimum of 20 years, more likely to last 40 or 50 years. So it's not as if we're guaranteeing, or as if the market is guaranteeing those units' revenues. So the goal was to move to a market mechanism, whereas, as I indicated, the risk is on the investors. We're not taking away from them by having a regulatory guaranteed contract for 20 or 30 years at a price which is not linked to the market. Now, when people talk about long-term contracts now and the potential benefits of them, it really only makes sense when there's a market reference. The market reference in this case would be the RPM market and the LNP markets. But trying to establish the long-term value of contracts outside of a market reference has been demonstrated to be difficult or impossible.
Just a final question. Did I hear you say earlier that RPM is necessary not only to incent new investment, but to cover costs as well, and that the energy prices aren't covering them?
When we're thinking about the total cost, that is fixed costs and variable costs, yes. So just take as an example, if you're a peaking unit, a new peaking unit, and peaking units are setting the margin or setting the price 30% of the time, then if you're setting the price at your marginal cost, there's no contribution to your fixed costs. And so either there needs to be scarcity revenues in the energy market or comparable revenues in the capacity market to provide an incentive for such a unit to be built. Otherwise, you simply won't get peaking units built.
Doctor, thank you. We need to talk some more.
I'd be happy to. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Are there any more questions for the witness?
I'd just like to make one comment. I can assure you in Pennsylvania, there are no PURPA contracts that are based upon natural gas escalation factors. I can assure you of that.
Are there any other comments or questions? thing in all. Invited.
Thank you.
Chairman, needs a minimal introduction since he's the former chairman of this commission. Ben R. Thomas, PJM Provider Group.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Commissioners, Chairman Cawley, Vice Chairman Christie, Commissioners Pizzengrilli, Powelson, and Gardner. It's certainly a pleasure to be here this afternoon. I have submitted formal written comments for consideration and inclusion in the record, but there's just, I guess, something about being in this room that makes me want to rip up those formal comments and go off the cuff here. So, submit those comments for the record. However, the purpose of this testimony or for this oral presentation, I'll summarize those comments as well as hopefully respond to some of the questions that have been asked by the commissioners so far. Let me start by applauding the commission for conducting this hearing. I think this is wonderful to see the level of attention and detail that's being paid to wholesale markets. The competitive wholesale markets in Pennsylvania and the competitive wholesale markets serving Pennsylvania are critically important to the overall health and economy of this Commonwealth. It is absolutely appropriate to study, understand, question when appropriate, challenge when appropriate, and get a better and deeper understanding of how these wholesale markets are indeed working for Pennsylvania. So I applaud you for having this hearing, and it's certainly a pleasure to be part of it. Let me introduce the PJM Power Providers Group to you, since this is our first time testifying before this commission. The P3 Group is a 501c6 nonprofit corporation dedicated to promoting properly designed and well-functioning wholesale markets in the PJM region. We are an 11-company organization. We represent approximately 75,000 megawatts of power in the PJM region. Our members own over 51,000 miles of transmission lines and serve 12.2 million customers. My comments today do not necessarily reflect the views of individual members of organizations. The views presented here this afternoon are my own. Again, I have submitted the written testimony, but let me summarize and let me try to make this as relevant as I can to your charge as state commissioners. When formulating any electricity policy, 5 years ago I probably would have said there are two main tenets that you need to strive for. Now I'm going to add a third. But namely, as a state commission entrusted with the public trust, you're responsible for ensuring a reliable supply of power at the lowest reasonable cost. And now the third one, while balancing the environmental goals of the Commonwealth. It's a relatively simple proposition, but as you all are finding out and all I'm sure know, it's very difficult to balance all the forces and factors that need to be balanced in order to achieve that mission. Yeah, but ultimately, I think any policy and any recommendation you reflect upon needs to get back to that tenet. You know, are we promoting reliability? Are we doing so at the lowest reasonable cost? And are we staying consistent with the environmental policies that have been set forth by the Commonwealth? So let me address each individually. First of all, reliability. And I don't want to duplicate the testimony that's been given prior, but certainly, you know, Andy Ott walked through operationally how PJM is ensuring that reliability maintains in place from an operations perspective. And I think Vice Chairman Christie's acknowledgement of what an excellent job they're doing in this regard is very well founded. Indeed, Pennsylvania is very fortunate to have many, many hardworking men and women in Norristown, Pennsylvania, working just to keep the system running, balanced, and keeping the lights on. From a transmission perspective, there is a very robust transmission planning process in PJM. Again, this wasn't touched on. There's been $10 billion of projects approved since 2000. I think we all know and appreciate and understand that in order to have robust markets, we need robust infrastructure to move the commodities within that market. And I think Commissioner Powelson's remarks in that are right on the money. from a generation perspective, there's a lot that's been said about capacity markets today, and again, I appreciate many of the questions that have been asked and answered. But let me perhaps provide a little bit of historical, or put maybe an emphasis on some of the historical issues surrounding capacity markets. Certainly when I was on the commission, it was no secret, I was very very critical of capacity markets at the time. Joe Bowring and I spent a lot of time talking in 2001 and 2002 and 2003 about capacity markets and how to get them right. And as you heard today, there were billions of dollars being spent in capacity markets in 2001. And from my perspective, it was hard to see the value proposition from those capacity markets at the time. Let me just add on that. Prior to the introduction of RPM, reserve margins were declining in PJM. Reliability issues were looming. Generators were not recovering their fixed costs. There were problems. It wasn't working. And eventually, FERC found this structure to be unjust and unreasonable. Something needed to be done. And that's why RPM, at least the debates surrounding RPM, began. And there were many, many years of debate on RPM. There was an extensive stakeholder process. This is a tough issue. I mean, because ultimately the very question here is a very difficult question to answer, but one that must be answered and answered correctly, and that is, how do you ensure reliability in a competitive marketplace? Capacity markets are the mechanisms to get that job done. There was a long debate about how to do that. You know, ultimately, there was a stakeholder process that led to a filing by PJM. That PJM filing ended up in a FERC stakeholder process. Eventually, a settlement was submitted on that. But there was a very long process associated with getting to the point where even RPM was approved by FERC. And since RPM has been in place, we've had five auctions. I would encourage you to read the Brattle report that was issued when June of this year. They did, a thoroughly professional job analyzing the first five RPM auctions. They explained how those troubling trends in capacity have been reversed in PJM, how we are seeing reserve margins that were in the -1, -2 range from target now being the +1, +2% range. We have seen how some of those reliability concerns have been lifted. We have seen how investment has gone to the areas where it needs to go. We have seen enormous upticks in demand response, and I was really encouraged to hear Mr. Ott's comment today that, you know, he anticipates demand response to go up even more in the next auction. And that's another thing I think RPM, you know, through all its controversy, tends to get missed. RPM is not just about new generation. In fact, new generation is less than half of the RPM puzzle. I mean, we have seen tremendous response from the demand side. We've seen increases in imports into PJM. We've seen new investment into existing facilities. We've seen scheduled retirements come off the books, and plants that were scheduled to be retired are now looking to do the upgrades necessary to keep those plants running. We have reversed the trend, folks, and that's a very positive story. Which then begs the question that Chairman Cawley asked, you know, are we doing so at the appropriate price? Yes, we've solved the reliability issue. Have we resolved the price issue? And to that, I just, you know, I would encourage you all to very carefully read the work of Dr. Bowring. The State of the Market report comes out every March. You know, certainly as a commissioner, I read it, honestly, every time it came out. It's a terrible read. It's long. You know, the characters are not well developed. But it's an extraordinarily, you know, in-depth, professional analysis of what our wholesale markets look like. And it is the single source where you can go and answer all these questions about price, reliability, and it's very well done. I would certainly commend that to all of you. So, again, we've reversed this troubling trend. Have we done so at a fair price? I would encourage you to read the State of the Market report. Look at what the analysts have said. Look at the filings that have made. You know, certainly, yes, these prices are higher than they were before, but they certainly come in within the zone of reasonableness. They are reflective of the fact that capacity is more expensive than it was in prior years. They are leading to new investment, and I think that is ultimately what is good. But on that note, I would maybe add, a caution, and that is something else that we've realized pretty remarkably here today, and that is markets fluctuate and can sometimes fluctuate quite significantly. While it's tempting to take snapshot views in the market and judge the overall health, I really encourage all of you to take a long-term view on markets. You know, try to look at these markets over a series of years, not a single moment of time. You know, just this summer, we were paying, you know, $4.50 for a gallon of gasoline. Probably at that time, a lot of folks and a lot of experts said if you locked in a price of $4.10 for the next 10 years for a gallon of gasoline, you would have made a great decision and would have been a huge winner. Well, we saw what happened. The market moved, and the market moved quite dramatically, and now, you know, on the way in this morning, I saw gas for $2.50. I think the same caution needs to apply to electricity policy. Like I said, while it's very tempting and it's very frustrating, you know, that we're looking at this at an occasion when the rate caps are expiring, I think there's a point to be made that we need to look at these markets over a series of years, not just at a single moment in time, because markets do fluctuate. They do go up and down with fuel costs. And, you know, trying to predict the market as regulators is a very, very, very tricky gamble, quite frankly. Whether it's an RFP done at PJM for new capacity or other forms of commitments like that. Just, I mean, maybe a couple concluding thoughts, and I'd really like to get through this so I can entertain your questions. But, you know, I understand and appreciate these are challenging times. Indeed, you know, prices are up, although, as we've heard today, prices are coming back down. Again, from my perspective, it's important to keep a long-term perspective. You know, the foundation is very solid here in Pennsylvania. Yes, there's work to be done in PJM. Yes, these markets are not perfect, and yes, it's very appropriate for state regulators throughout the footprint to be very involved in the process that formulates the policies. Whether it's PJM or OM or MISO, you know, the role of state commissions here is critical. But ultimately, the foundation of the market, the foundation of PJM, and the foundation of MISO, for that matter, fundamentally sound markets, functional markets, competitive markets, markets that are producing competitive outcomes, that are delivering value to your consumers. The challenge for state regulators is to develop retail policies that support those markets, that bring out the best of those markets, and ultimately give the consumers the power and the tools that they need to compete and win. The foundation is solid. It's now the charge of this commission to build upon that foundation. Thank you very much, Chairman, Commissioners, and we appreciate any questions you would have.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Glenn, for being here today. I probably would agree that I'll disagree with most of your testimony, and we've had these discussions in the past. I don't agree that we're on solid foundation in this state. And I'll just give you one example that gives me some real concern. Just take a look at Allegheny Energy and draw a 50-mile radius circle of Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Virginia. And in West Virginia, Maryland, and Pennsylvania. Potomac Edison in West Virginia, they're regulated. The rates haven't gone anywhere in 20 years. There's some pressure right now on some fuel price adjustments, so that will change to some degree. Maryland, the rates are unregulated. And you have industrial rates in Maryland, unregulated, that are twice as high as the rates in regulated West Virginia. And I think, find any more striking example of some of the disparities between regulated and unregulated and the impact of the difference in prices. So I just have some real concern where we're headed here with a unregulated wholesale market with all the pricing mechanisms that have been established. And I, quite frankly, very, very concerned about the health of our industrial sector as we move forward with the rate caps coming off and what that might mean to the consumer or to our economy at the end of the day. We had an example there in Maryland where Alcoa closed its plant down. I think it's pretty one of the more famous cases. So I'm concerned that the prices in these RTOs compared to the non-RTO, the regulated environments, is not moving in the right direction to keep us on a solid foundation. I think the volatility that we have now is a very troublesome issue for our industrials and major consumers to handle on how they plan. So I probably have some more comments here, and you and I will probably agree to disagree on some of these items. But I'll stop and...
Sure. I appreciate that. I'd love to say I'm right and you're wrong. I think... No, I'm kidding. That was a joke. let me just respond to a couple points. First of all, I mean, these are not unregulated markets. They're heavily regulated markets. FERC is constantly watching these markets. Dr. Bowering is watching these markets. They're very specific rules. The PJM tariff is enormous. They are heavily regulated. They are carefully watched. They are monitored to ensure that the competitive outcomes are there. In terms of the differences between Maryland and West Virginia, I can't speak, obviously, specifics to Allegheny. But I would note that, Maryland has quite different environmental restrictions and rules than West Virginia. And as a matter of fact, I have one member of an organization that just spent $1 billion to move their plants into compliance with the Maryland environmental regulations. Those investments that were made in those upgrades were not rate-based recovery mechanisms. They were at-risk dollars. These companies made those with the hopes of recovering those dollars in the market. And finally, I too am very concerned about the industrial base in Pennsylvania. Nobody wants to see jobs in this Commonwealth more than I do. I was happy to see U.S. Steel's announcement that they're announcing the massive expansion of their Clarendon facilities. I think that is a positive sign, certainly. I think there are other positive signs that we can point to from the expansion of industrial. And I'm sure for every plant I say that open in Pennsylvania, there's probably one that can be pointed to that decided to move away from Pennsylvania. But clearly a company like U.S. Steel, and I very hesitate to speak for them because I don't know much about what went into that decision there. But I'm sure they evaluated other places where they could expand, but for various reasons chose Clarendon. If I could just say general, I always appreciate the comments and the perspective, and these are very important debates, and having these discussions is critically important, and appreciate engaging as always.
I could go on for some other ones, but we could probably have sidebar on some of these issues.
Sure.
Probably what disturbs me the most about what we have done here with deregulation is in 1996. We placed such a small price tag on the power plants. I've done some research, and it looks like we valued the plants at about $318 per kW across the board in Pennsylvania. And in one case, look at Three Mile Island, where you strip out the uranium fuel part of it, and the plant was valued at $25 million. And we valued them at that level because there was no market. And then as we sit here today, and the development of the single market clearing price, the RPM, these congestion costs, these power plants now are literally worth many, many, many billions of dollars more. And so as I look back at this, I find it hard to reconcile the decision that we made to give away those power plants at those cheap prices. Because now, when the caps come off, we have to buy the power from the market, and the market's been lifted so high. And I just think that we gave away those power plants too cheap. And as far as looking at the legacy issues, the elevation of this power market with all these value streams, I think, has deprived the ratepayers of the bargain that they made in 1996, is that there would be, the plants would be fully depreciated, stranded costs would be paid off, and you'd have the cheap running costs of these units as the basis for securing power to get the discounts. it hasn't worked out that way. And I think that will soon be evident here as the caps come off in 2010 and 2011.
I mean, a couple of thoughts, and you know, yes, you know, the law passed in 1996. With the framework of the restructuring, and then ultimately the settlements were where the decisions were made about stranded cost recovery and the value of the plants and what have you. And you know, all I can say is, you know, and it goes to a comment that I said earlier about the the variances that occur in the energy markets. At the time, there were numerous experts, around the country, in Pennsylvania, making certain predictions about, future energy costs. I can remember going to a presentation, I believe it was like maybe 98 or so, where, this nationally recognized natural gas expert was predicting that natural gas would go up about 35 to 40% to $2.50, and then stay there for a long time. I guess what I'm saying is, at the time, there were certain assumptions that went into those decisions, that were made with the best available facts. And I would also add, that those settlements were agreed to by consumer advocates, industrial advocates, environmental advocates. Everyone sitting around the table largely agreed to those prices. Hindsight could be 20/20, sure, but at the time, with the facts that were available at the time, and literally with, all the parties sitting around the table with the best available facts at the disposal, those were the reasoned decisions that were made. And like I said, ultimately, I think most all of them were settlements, if not all.
I think I agree with your comments there about the fuel price assumptions, and if the natural gas prices would more converge with the coal prices, I think we'd have a little more uniform result in Pennsylvania for the net price coming out of our coal and nuclear plants. But as you get that price of natural gas spiking on the margin, I think that's where it produces the higher than deserved prices for the coal and the nuclear power prices.
Yeah, and the spread between natural gas and coal always bears watching. I mean, but again, that moves too, as you know.
Okay. I don't have any further questions. Again, thanks for coming in and appreciate your perspectives. Thanks,
Glenn. Thank you.
Commissioner Paulson.
Glenn, thanks for being here. Welcome back.
Thank you.
This past September, you wrote an article that I have a copy of, good editorial in the Patriot News, entitled Preventing Blackouts, Investment Bolster Regional Electrical Power Grid. And quoting in the Brattle Group report, and tying in some of your comments in this article, with the current collapse in the capital markets, are you concerned about potential liquidity constraints hampering new generation and reliability here in the PJM footprint?
Yes, I mean, I am concerned, I think trying to predict the capital markets at this point is very challenging. But, again, I'd like to move the RPM debate a little bit off the notion that it's all about new generation. It's about new resources and improving the reliability prognosis of this region. Like I said, a new build is almost as valuable, if not more valuable, as Graham Edwards said, than, a megawatt of demand response, energy efficiency, what have you. All these resources, we should be talking about ways to incent new resources, and it's not just new generation. But yes, I mean, there are going to be some challenges for new generation. I think it's too early to tell how that's going to work its way out, but it's certainly something that, this commission and others, PJM and MISO, should continue to watch because, like I said, there's a lot of uncertainty out there right now, and it's quite frankly too early to determine how that's going to work out.
Thank you.
Commissioner Pitson-Gurley.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Sure.
Along the lines of Commissioner Paulson, do you feel that the uncertainty surrounding environmental regulations is impacting decisions to invest in new generation in Pennsylvania? And if so, do you see that changing anytime in the near future?
Well, the second part's a little harder to answer than the first part, but yeah, I mean, many of my members of my organization, carbon is a significant question for them. What are your carbon risks moving forward? A giant question mark. But if you really really look inside the numbers, particularly in the Brattle report, I think some of this might, the market might be sorting out some of this stuff already. You know, very little of the new resources that are coming online, you know, have carbon issues. A lot of them are non-carbon solutions, demand response, natural gas, solar, wind, you know, upgrades to nuclear plants. So, yes, it is a significant issue. Yes, there is significant risk. But, you know, I would submit that, you know, the market is already planning a little bit for that risk. And you can see that reflected in at least some of the activity that occurred in the last RPM auction. And I would, you know, look forward to seeing the results from the next one to see if that trend continues.
And one more question. Do you have an opinion on whether the recent merger and acquisition activities will enhance or hurt the competitiveness of the wholesale energy market?
I mean, ultimately, yeah. I mean, that's going to be an issue that FERC's going to have to straighten out. I mean, you know, the merger and acquisition activity has been... you know, relatively limited until the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks. But, you know, certainly when evaluating any merger, any acquisition, you know, FERC has a responsibility to ensure that the appropriate market screens are or appropriate market protections are in place. I'm sure Dr. Bowring is going to have some thoughts on that, and we'll be evaluating, you know, anything that goes on in PJM in that regard. But, yeah, I mean, market power is obviously always going to be an issue in a merger or acquisition like that, and needs to be considered by the FERC.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioner Gardner.
Thank you. And thank you for coming, and we're glad that we were able to get you onto the program today.
Appreciate it very much.
I've heard quite a few comments about the RPM as being an incentive for increased capacity within PJM, and my question is simply, is RPM, is PJM's geographical growth, does that have more of a contribution to the increase in capacity within PJM, or is it solely on RPM?
It's hard to answer that question in black and white. I mean, that's why I prefer to look at the trends. The trend before RPM was, you know, even accounting for population growth, the trend before RPM was that away from reliability, towards reliability violations, shrinking reserve margins, generators not recovering their fixed costs. The trend after RPM has been reversed on almost every score. So even accounting, and all those trends account for population growth, demand growth. So even accounting for all that, I think it's fair, you know, well, it's impossible to sit here and say, you know, in every instance, but for RPM, this would never have happened. Again, in every instance, there's some you can say that for. I think it's more important to take a step back and look at the trend. And clearly, there's a trend that's being reversed in PJM as a result of RPM.
Okay. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that position. And in particular, I'll ask, if new generation is going up in states where the environmental laws are less restrictive than, say, as you move towards to the Atlantic Ocean. So are plants being built in Kentucky, Ohio, Indiana versus Pennsylvania, Maryland, New Jersey?
You know, and maybe Andy Ott's in a better position to answer this one than I am, but, you know, because a lot of this, some of this data is quite frankly confidential, and I don't necessarily know where all these new resources are coming from. But, you know, it's, I think when you look at the RPM results, one of the things that struck me, particularly in the last auction, is the relative diversity of new resources that we're seeing. There was solar, there was wind, there was natural gas, there was coal, there was nuclear, there was demand response. And, you know, geographically speaking, I'm not sure I can sit here and say where each of those megawatts is coming from. But what I can say is that there is a fairly diverse array of resources coming online. And Andy, I don't know if you want to... Oh, it is. There you go. It's posted state by state on the website.
Mr. Chairman.
Glenn, as a former member of this commission, I'm sure you understand our frustration because we don't deal with wholesale issues as much as we do retail ones, but the public doesn't understand that. They don't understand that we still regulate the distribution side, but not the generation side anymore. I wish to make it clear that neither I nor any of my colleagues are particularly against RPM or other market design simply for the sake of frustration or because of frustration. We simply need to understand and be convinced that customers who are going to, over whose bill we are ultimately responsible, are getting value for their money. So if you're going to create an artificial market design, we want to make sure that it's the most efficient market design so that that price you're talking about is not going to be inflated or it's not going to appear to be going to people who really don't need it. And that's why I earlier asked PJM if they would voluntarily provide me with some justification of why existing generation should receive energy, ancillary, and RPM revenues all in support of their costs. Now, if there's more to it than that, that's what we need to understand. Because if we don't believe that customers are getting the best market design on the wholesale side, then we have an obligation to advocate before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to change it so that whatever that design does provides a fair, just, and reasonable result. So that's the kind of frustration you hear this morning, but I for my part, I want to assure everybody here and everybody who's listening that we're not against new generation in Pennsylvania. I mean, if RPM is the way to get it done fairly and efficiently and economically, well, that's fine. But it sure appears that there are some problems, and I think it should be evident from what you've heard here this afternoon that we need a lot more education before we're convinced that this is the way to go. So, again, thanks for your part, and if you have something to respond, please
sure.
Do.
Yeah, and again, and that's why I started my presentation by applauding the commission for having these hearings. I mean, I think it is wonderful that you are having these hearings, and the questions that have been asked today are fantastic. I mean, it shows a real appreciation of the issues that are at stake here. You know, one of the first things I did when I left the commission, I probably should have done it when I was on the commission, I was preparing for a speech, and I took my electricity bill and sat down and broke out the charges on my bill that were attributed to, quote-unquote, the Public Utility Commission and state policies versus, you know, the interstate market and federal policies. And about two-thirds of those charges were attributable to the federal regional side of things. Yet the irony is, as you pointed out, as a commissioner, you know, certainly from a perception standpoint, you're responsible for the entire bill. So it is indeed perfect. It is appropriate. It is right. And again, I commend the commission for having these hearings. But you know, let me leave with another thought here, because I think there's an enormous opportunity here for this commission. You know, one of the things, trends, at least at PJM, probably in the late 90s, even the early 2000s, is there was an enormous amount of civility in the stakeholder process. There still is a fair degree of civility, but you know, back then, it seemed like a lot of issues were getting resolved through the stakeholder process, worked out, buyers and sellers could get together and work through issues very effectively. I have been concerned, you know, a little bit about the trend in the last few years that instead of working through issues together, that complaints are filed at FERC and we end up litigating this stuff all at FERC. And there have been numerous complaints. I'm not just talking about RPM. I'm talking about many other issues. Somewhat I agree, you know, were appropriate and needed to get done. But I think, you know, from this commission's perspective, you know, in state commissions, and Commissioner Gardner talked about the four commissioners who filed four commissions that filed the complaint. State commissions really are in a unique position to drive consensus in the PJM process. By virtue of the responsibilities you hold and the public trust you share with the federal regulators, you really have the ability to drive consensus in a lot of these debates. So I would really, you know, implore this commission, you know, yes, I understand the frustration. In some respects, I share the frustration. But I would, I guess, really urge this commission to take that frustration and turn it into an opportunity to engage in the PJM process and engage in a way that drives consensus, not litigation. So I appreciate the thoughts and thank you for the opportunity.
Are there any other questions or comments for the witness? Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Well, Mr. Mann, whatever distinction there is in being last, you certainly have it. So without further ado, I'll just simply say we've saved the best until last.
So thank you. Can you hear now?
No, sir. I wish I could tell you I'm good with microphones, but I'm not. Just swap with Mr. Thomas.
Okay.
Very okay.
By listening to this testimony before I start, I feel like a mouse in a room full of cats here. Because I'm a customer, and a fairly large customer at that. Our power bill runs around $4 million a year. And under this deregulation, we think we're looking at that cost to go up 50%. That's not an insignificant sum. And I will briefly go over my remarks and then answer questions. We're a recycler of steel scrap. We're really an iron foundry. We make industrial parts for farm machinery, water pumps, military equipment. And we operate in three counties in Pennsylvania, Lancaster, York, and Mifflin. And we're looking to currently expand capacity in the U.S., spending $10 million over 4 years, and this expansion of production jobs is now on hold because these investments have a 10 to 20-year life, and the return on this investment depends greatly on what we will be paying for electric power. And our primary issue is our inability to know within reasonable bounds of what we will be paying for electric power over that time period versus what we would experience in a non-deregulated states. Under the old system, companies like Donsco had a stable and predictable environment for its electric power. While there may have been overcapacity, there was good reliability, few brownouts, and reasonable, predictable costs. We're now faced with an unstable and an unpredictable market. PPL cannot today tell us what our power rates will be in 2010. So my question is, how can we plan? The irony is Donsco's foundries are sitting next to Three Mile Island, Peach Bottom nuclear plants, the Brunner Island coal-fired plant, Muddy Run pump power stores, York Haven, Safe Harbor, Holtwood, and Conowingo dams, the world's largest concentration of power plants. And the majority of that power produced in our backyard is exported out of the state, and we who live here under the shadow of these plants receive no benefit for our proximity. Shouldn't there be incentives for plants to locate close to power plants to reduce the need for transmission lines? Deregulation has also made the installation of new power feeds financially onerous. Where in the past the utility would design and install the necessary lines, now the cost of a 69 kVA line is a direct upfront cost to the user, and such a policy is a big disincentive for industry to locate here or to expand capacity. In my opinion, this deregulation benefits only the power companies that promise cost reductions have not materialized for us consumers. But cost reductions that have occurred appear to have benefited the power companies who have no downside risk in this environment. To that point, the stranded cost payments from Donsco Inc. over the past 5 years has amounted to over $1.5 million. That is money that went solely to beef up the utility's balance sheets without us ever getting something in return, such as equity in their companies or new power feeds. That money we paid amounts to a direct taking, as those so-called stranded costs have turned out to be phantom. The fact is, this new deregulated environment will turn out to be a tremendous disincentive for my company and others. Instead of focusing our attention on the difficult job of making castings, we're being forced to become amateur speculators in the electric market, where we're at a severe disadvantage to professional speculators. As far as I can tell, the promised benefits to us of electrical deregulation are nowhere to be seen for Donsco Incorporated.
And, sir, does that conclude your remarks?
Yes, it does.
Thank you. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. You mentioned that your current bill is around $4 million a year.
Yes.
And with a 50% increase at a couple million dollars more a year, how will that affect you at the end of the day, that bottom line, a $2 million additional cost?
I mean, we'll wipe it out. It's going to put a major dent into it. Probably, yes, it would cut our profits at least in half.
I think we had a brief little discussion. I hope you can consider some self-generation opportunities, at least scrub those numbers to see if that might be a vehicle for you to get the predictable and more stable type of electric rate that might help you plan. Now, I know that's not an easy task, but hopefully we can foster an environment here in the state of Pennsylvania where we encourage either self-generation by yourself, or we can have third parties who step up to the plate and propose generation resources to you that might give you that stability. I think for the industrial sector, I think that's the unsung hero here moving forward, is the opportunity to generate your own electricity and take control of your own destiny. And I know that's not an easy thing, maybe your location, but look forward to working with you to maybe explore those options and maybe even teaming up with some other industrials and building or taking an interest maybe in another plant to help try to mitigate some of the increases that are looming for you in the next couple of years.
Then why, if I were in West Virginia, I wouldn't be facing this problem?
Well, we don't want you to go to West Virginia, so you got to work with us. We'll do everything we can.
Thank you. Commissioner Paulson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mann, for being here, and thank you for being a job creator here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and I'd like to echo my colleague. We want you to stay here and grow your business here. Let me first start off. I think Governor Rendell has really taken a lead role in really separating Pennsylvania among other states as energy independence strategy. So I, with the passage of House Bill 2200, thanks in large part to Senator Tomlinson and Senator Piscola's leadership, we have new tools in place for you to manage your energy output. And I'm curious, have you looked at demand-side management technologies within the worksite, looking at accessing some of the grant programs that we have available through DCED to help your company?
Yes, we have. And we operate off-peak. We don't operate our foundries during the day. We have spinning reserve. We have interruptible power. And interestingly enough, under this deregulated environment and this buying and selling of companies, in our Belleville plant, when it was MedEd, we had 8 days of interruptible power.
Right.
And they used to take, when they really needed it, about 4 to 5 days. But they get bought out by, I think, of the company out of Ohio. Now it becomes Penn Electric or Pennsylvania Electric, whatever it is.
First Energy. Yeah.
First Energy, yes. Immediately, before the 1st of July, they called up and used all 8 days. So instead of the interruptible power being used for just that, to help the grid stabilize, they used it for profitability. So then you came in July and August when they actually needed it, they'd call up, they started to call up and say, well, gee, can't you, drop offline tonight or something and give us a break? So a lot of the rules, things that were in place with this deregulated environment, it's now doesn't serve industry. First Energy has no interest in keeping jobs in Pennsylvania. None. What incentive do they have? We have to put in a 69 kVA feed into our Mount Joy plant. Now, I'm not in the, that means a transmission line has to go across properties right away. That's $1.5 million upfront cost. We never had those costs before. So that it becomes, in terms of expansion and new jobs and added capacity, right? That gets a lot more difficult and makes the investment hurdle that much greater. So the state programs make you borrow money to do this. And our credit's limited. We're not that big a company. We don't have access to New York money, as the power companies do.
Now, let me ask you a question. Would you want to favor going back to the old system?
Absolutely.
Okay. Just expand on why you'd want to go back to the old system. If the reliability equation you just talked about is a concern.
I know for a fact that a neighbor of mine worked for PP&L Lines. I don't mean to knock PP&L, but he said our repair crews have been cut by 60%. Our orders now are to fix only if it breaks. Mm-hmm. All the preventive work is off the table now. That doesn't make me feel too good. It doesn't make me feel that our reliability is being enhanced. We used to get whether our prices would be higher under deregulation or the PP&L would have its grid. It was a very efficient operation under deregulation, and the money we paid them for stranded costs, where'd the money go? Montana? Argentina? England? How does that affect us in Pennsylvania? So I'd venture to say under the old rules, we would be more, PP&L grid would be more like West Virginia. As Mr. Christie's pointed out, their rates are much lower and obviously much more stable. And I think that's what we would have here today.
Appreciate your testimony here this afternoon. Commissioner Pitts and Grilly.
Thank you. Thank you for coming today. And as you can hear, we are listening and we hear your concerns. And I know you met with our colleague last week, and we hope to meet with you in the future and talk about some options that may be available. And as Commissioner Paulson said, the bill that the governor signed into law last week certainly provides some new tools for our businesses, and we want you to continue to grow and thrive in Pennsylvania. So hopefully we can talk about that after this hearing today.
Thank you. Commissioner Gardner.
Mr. Mann, thank you very much for coming in today and providing this impactful testimony. Just a bit for the record, how many people are you employing at Dunsco?
Yesterday it was 521.
Did something happen today?
No. Some people don't show up for work every day.
And where specifically are you located?
We have a foundry in Belleville, Pennsylvania, Mount Joy, Pennsylvania, and Wrightsville, Pennsylvania, and a machine shop in Wrightsville, Pennsylvania.
And for those of us who are from southeastern Pennsylvania, could you help locate that on the map for us?
Which one you want?
All three.
Well, Wrightsville on the Susquehanna River between Lancaster and York. Mm-hmm. Mount Joy is on the way to Harrisburg from Lancaster, off Route 283, along the railroad line. And Belleville's in maybe 30 miles south of State College, in one of those happy valleys going up through the... it's a farm community.
So I guess it's safe to say that you're dead in the heart of Pennsylvania and kind of reflect pretty much what a typical Pennsylvania business could be experiencing in the current energy environment.
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, Art, you and I have talked twice now in a week. We met last Friday when I met with a number of businessmen in Landisville. And you spoke eloquently then, and you have done so again this afternoon. Let me quibble with you a little bit. I think in exchange for your stranded cost payments, you've had capped rates since 1997, and it's now going to be the expiration of those rates, which is going to cause you the most heartburn. Let me try to fathom why you'd want to go back to the old way being cost of service rate making. I think you, if we had stayed at cost of service rate making and the Electric Competition Act had never been passed, your costs would be much higher already, because PPL would have been in on a regular basis for rate increases, and they certainly would be higher, maybe not as high as they are going to be, because under the old system, larger customers receive power at 3.5 cents a kilowatt hour. They thought they could do better, and they were the initial initiators of electric competition in Pennsylvania. They thought they could do better if they could go directly to suppliers. Well, what's happened, of course, is the cost of generation has gone up, and I don't think anybody can get it at 3.5 cents unless somebody is subsidizing the rate. So any way you look at it, the cost of generation is really what's causing all of us problems, including you. I think the answer here, first of all, if this noble experiment works, is that your resort is to have to alternative suppliers. If PP&L cannot provide you a individual case basis contract that would help you at a rate lower than it would otherwise be in the wholesale market, and I don't think they can, because under the law now there can't be cross subsidization between rate classes. So if PPL can't help you, you would be a prime candidate for any number of a dozen or more EGSs doing business in this state, whom I suspect would be who would be delighted to do business with you. Now, you haven't heard from them yet because PPL's rate caps are still in place. But it's not, of course, too soon to start talking with them. Maybe they don't know about you yet, but I would be shocked if they wouldn't want to talk with you. Failing that, self-generation is a possibility, and that's why U.S. Steel has looked at it and other large users. But you, if I hear you right, you're in three different locations, so that presents a problem. And you don't really want to go into the cogeneration business. You want to run a foundry, so that may not be an option either. What would be remaining? Well, I've had this discussion with large industrial customers on at least four occasions, and with the governor twice, because he's very concerned about businesses like yours. He doesn't want them to leave Pennsylvania. And I heard you in Landisville. What you said is you've got to compete globally, and even though the United States is resurgent in your type of heavy industry, your type of foundry business, you have to compete not only with like businesses in other states, but internationally. So what do we do to keep you here? Well, what I have said to my industrial friends so far and what I've told the governor is, if people like you who provide jobs, who provide taxes, who provide charity and philanthropy in your community, if we need to keep people like you in Pennsylvania, which we certainly do, then you deserve to be subsidized in some fashion. And I would be the first to defend that, because that's really what we used to do under cost of service rate making. So even if we don't scrap the electric competition experiment, we need to keep people like you in Pennsylvania, one way or another, because you are too valuable to the people of Pennsylvania to let you go. But on the other hand, I can't very well subsidize you without simultaneously undermining the whole competitive marketplace. Because if you're going to get a subsidized rate, no EGS is going to be able to give you a deal. But if the EGS deal isn't going to do it, and we got to do something else to keep you here, then I think our legislature ought to provide that incentive. That's where I'm at. That really wasn't a question, was it?
It's never my intention to look for subsidies, and I really don't think they're a good idea. But my, you know, listening to, I mean, my background's as an economist, though I was a nuclear engineer. Matter of fact, I was in a supervisory position of the shipping port reactor. That's in the Rickover staff. So I'm familiar with this whole field. And I think the whole idea of the clearing price for the market, I've never agreed with it. I think it's a great way to enrich power companies. I've even thought and talked to a local commissioners that really what we need to do for our own local area, because we're sitting under in all these power plants, we're sitting right there, and we get no benefit from it. It's going to the grid. It's going to New Jersey. They don't want the plants. We get it. So why don't we just have York and Lycoming County take Safe Harbor? But it's a dam, 1 cent a kilowatt hour. They're getting paid 18 cents a kilowatt hour on peak, right? Wonderful. I mean, it's a great investment. And they got it under deregulation for not a lot of money. And if we went back to buy it, you can bet your little bippy that they're going to have that price will be 10 to 20 times, right, what it was deregulated for. So I don't know what the answer is, and we'll probably as a company have to put off this expansion until we see how this settles out. Because 10 years ago or 8 years ago, I was told to take down my cupola melt furnace by the DEP and basically told you will go electric. So $8 million later at a Riceville plant, we had a 14 megawatt melt units. So I think the answer for people like us is we have to depend on, like I say, I feel like a cat. I'm in a room full of cats and I'm a mouse. And we're the meal. We're the customer. And we're expected to pay for the profitability of the companies. And you look at PP&L's projections for 2010, their profits are due to at least double. And I would be better off actually if I bought PP&L stock today than investing in my own company. So I think I'll end my remarks there, but problem for companies like ours is we don't really know how we're going to buy power. Is it going to be by the hour? Will we get off-peak prices? Will the power companies be able to say, well, we'll try, as First Energy tried to do, was just to shrink the off-peak hours so they could get more money. They're not after jobs in Pennsylvania or keeping industry here. They're after their own profitability, and they can set rules of which we have no control over. So that's my concern.
Well, let's leave it there, but not really, because I think we ought to continue to talk with you and businesses like you. Thank you for your patience for listening to all these cats talk this morning.
Are there any other questions or comments for the witness? Mr. Chairman, have you decided on how closing remarks should be set forth?
Do any of my colleagues have any further? We have nothing further. Oh, you do? Commissioner Gardner.
First off, I really want to acknowledge the folks who are here in the room today and who have endured all of the testimony that we've received here. But I have to go on the record as saying that I'm disappointed that FERC was unable to send a representative to participate with us today. This hearing was largely driven by a conversation that I had with a FERC commissioner, and I thought that it was a good opportunity for us to sit down and exchange views and have the wholesale market participants and stakeholders understand how the actions that they take have an effect on Pennsylvania retail consumers. I think it's important for any regulatory agency, be it FERC or this Public Utility Commission, to hear what its stakeholders have to say. I believe it's safe to say that everyone here is concerned about the overall health of the wholesale electric markets and I really would encourage FERC to engage in a dialogue with this commission.
Thank you, Commissioner. Is there any other person who has remarks among the commissioners? With your approval, Mr. Chairman? All right. Thank everybody for attending today. I appreciate all of your remarks. We're adjourned.